We recently reported here on Eastern Standard that the annual report of the Appalachian Regional Commission, or ARC, listed most of eastern Kentucky's counties as distressed or at risk of becoming distressed. Employment in the region has continued to decline. The mining industry continues to suffer losses. Revelation Energy and its affiliate Black Jewel recently filed for bankruptcy, and that could affect more than 1,000 jobs in Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia. Sykes in Perry County just announced layoffs beginning in September, and that'll affect 179 employees. The company employs people from many counties, so the impact will be felt through a larger area. One local official within ARC's territory talked about it with WEKU's Stu Johnson at a gathering of county officials in Lexington. He believes selective regionalism could benefit the area. His county, Cumberland, is listed as at risk of becoming distressed. County Judge John Phelps says the biggest challenge remains employment.
Jobs, we need to do more to create more jobs, and at the same time, we've got to continue to develop a better workforce to attract those jobs. So, I mean, it's we've got leaps and bounds that we've got to do to create a better environment for our people.
Phelps says counties still want to maintain some autonomy, but joining up may work in selected cases.
I think regionally, a large corporation, I think it's something that, multiple counties could work together on together. Something that's centralized, and then, the things that may develop off that, spinoff companies, pods that may come off that, and then, set up shop in surrounding counties. So, I think there's benefits to both.
Phelps says there's been increased communication between secondary schools and technical schools. He says that can help usher students into technical jobs when that's appropriate. Phelps says regional cooperation with multiple counties can work, especially if the aim is to lure a large corporation to Appalachia. This spring, Brent Hutchinson, executive director of the Hindman Settlement School, learned that he had been chosen for an Obama Foundation fellowship, joining 19 other community-minded rising stars from all around the world for a two-year program that's designed to inspire a wave of civic innovation. So Dr. Hutchinson, a native of Eastern Kentucky and a Morehead State University graduate, is now trading insights and ideas with leaders representing 10 countries and 5 continents, all searching for solutions to many of the world's most pressing problems, problems like those that we see faced by the people of Appalachian Kentucky. He joins us from a studio at WMMT at Apple Shop in Whitesburg. Thanks for joining us, Brent, and congratulations on your selection as an Obama Fellow.
Thanks so much, Tom.
So the first fellows gathering, as I understand it, was in D.C. in May. Tell us about that and maybe some takeaways.
Sure. The fellows gathered in Washington, D.C. For 5 days, and we actually gathered alongside the first cohort, which was named last year. And it was 5 days of getting to know the Obama Foundation, what our responsibilities, honestly, would be as fellows, but also the opportunities that were being laid out before us. And so we spent the majority of that time getting to know one another, trying to unpack a little bit about why we are in that room as opposed to the 5,000 other people that it could have been, and really trying to figure out from there where we go from here, what we all kind of collectively are able to harness toward this wave, as they call a wave of civic innovation.
So a release about your selection says Obama Foundation fellows, quote, tackle big, complex issues in unique and inspiring ways. What sorts of issues are you taking to the table?
Well, I can tell you from a couple of different perspectives, what they say about the work we're doing at Hindman Settlement School is that we are approaching the issues we face in Eastern Kentucky from a holistic perspective and a community-based perspective in an effort to help people thrive where they live. And that's something, honestly, that I've talked about since I began my tenure at Hindman Settlement School 7 years ago. We live in rapidly changing times with multiple challenges that are incredibly complex, that are not just things that have been created and dropped on us recently, but things that we've been facing really for decades, for generations, honestly. And how do we figure out how people who live here now can thrive where they live, as opposed to having to go elsewhere in order to find means to an end, you know, an income that supports their lifestyle or appropriate education or healthcare or whatever it might be? How can we augment life here in such a way that if people want to be here, they don't have to look elsewhere? You know, smart people stay here and work here. We have creative ideas that are our own and that don't come from the outside. Those are the types of things that we've been thinking about for a while. And so the fellowship in many ways is a recognition of that effort.
And so that goes to what has been identified as a really serious problem for the region, and that is depopulation.
Yes, yeah, significant population. We have an out-migration that's not slowing down.
A huge advantage that cities have over rural communities is enormous local consumer bases. For rural communities in places like eastern Kentucky, the local consumer base is a lot thinner, and so there's only so much demand that can be pulled out of it. So how, in light of that, can rural communities survive, much less thrive?
That's a great question. Rural communities have survived for generations with very little. And so when we think about how we are using the resources that we have to move ourselves forward, you know, we have to be able to look at ourselves internally first to realize what we do have, with that we don't take our resources elsewhere, that we support things like local business and local efforts. But honestly, too, we have to be able to come together and say, you know, we want to define who we are. And so when we go outside, obviously we learn new things that are important to bring back home, but we can't do that to the degree that we allow other people to define what our legacy is going to look like and be. And so I think in many ways we've done that. You know, cities have much to offer. Rural places do too. And leaders in rural places certainly can't deny the ingenuity and the passion and the power that people in our locales actually possess.
We know that employment in the coal industry is now down to 0.6% of Kentucky's overall jobs picture. What other industries might return some prosperity to the region? Is there clarity about that, or do we just really not know?
That's a good question, too. I think that we're beginning to know. You know, what we know is that when coal jobs leave communities, about seven other jobs also leave communities. So it's not just about coal. We know that there's a residual kind of a ripple effect because of it. When I moved to Knott County in 2012, that was the same year that the last underground mine had closed there. And so I've seen what that's looked like in my time there and know that it's not just about coal jobs that are leaving. It's about people who are seeking opportunities elsewhere to try to figure out how they not only sustain their families, but give their kids opportunities to grow and thrive. And in order for that to change where we are, I think we, number one, have to look at the assets we have. And so in a place like Eastern Kentucky, that's as beautiful and hospitable as anywhere in the world, and I've had the opportunity to travel quite a bit, you know, we have the opportunity to draw people here from a tourism perspective, which I think matters. But we also have a lot going on outside of that. We know that local food and the local food movement is something that a lot of people around the country think is kind of cool, and they love going to the restaurants that are farm to table. We've done farm to table our whole existence, and it's something that has sustained us in very rich ways. I think it was now almost 2 years ago that Ronnie Lundy won the James Beard Award for her cookbook Vittles, which began to outline just the truth of Appalachian food and cooking and what that means for us. And that was a whole lot more than just a cookbook. And so we believe that at Hindman in particular, that local food and that movement is critical to helping people thrive where they live and not be taken advantage from the outside of high food prices and low food quality. We know that if we can maintain that where we are, that's big. You know, the broadband initiative that Congressman Rogers has really led the way on for us is one that could be a potential game changer in terms of opening up a global marketplace. And so we're following that closely. If people are able to stay here and be entrepreneurial and creative and start a business that can thrive from their home in Eastern Kentucky, that's a big deal for everybody in their community. And then on top of that, we've got an aging population that continues to have needs that can be met through innovative approaches to things like healthcare. And so there's really not one answer, in my opinion, for what a new economy in this new Appalachia looks like. It's a multifaceted answer that requires us working together and being creative together and thinking outside the box. There are probably things we can learn from the outside, but the answers are going to have to come from within, and they're going to be specifically, I think, derived from the people who are here who get it the most.
Any other big reforms that you see out there that need to take place before these things can be realized?
I'm not sure if I would say that I have a sense of what big reforms there could be, but I think one of the things that's true is that people who have a vested interest in the region have to stay in the region and work for its good for long periods of time. You know, social change does not take place quickly. It takes place over time. And so people who are working hard now with big ideas and fresh ideas and really good ideas, I think need to stick with them. And I think they need to see them through. And I think more than anything have to learn how to work together in a way that maybe they never have. You know, we tend to be fairly divided as a society right now, let alone in our local communities from one county to the next. You've got a 20-minute drive, but a completely different identity and a strong sense of what that place means and how it's different from what my place means. And there's something about that that's important and special, but at the same time, in order for us to move forward, we have to think a little bit larger than what it might mean for Knott County or Letcher County or where I grew up in Lawrence County. We might have to think regionally, and we might have to think across communities, and that's not something that we've done incredibly well for a long period of time. I think that movement in that direction, the ability to lock arms with one another with common goals and trying to move past the divisiveness of things like politics or economy, you know, the economic divide that we face, those are things that we're going to have to embrace in order for us to be able to move forward.
Well, we're going through a period of transition, of transformation, of experimentation, of uncertainty. And all of those things imply change, which is difficult for people to wrap their arms around. But it may be necessary right now. Do you think that we're just going to have to be comfortable with throwing a lot of stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks?
Maybe to some degree. One of my college professors said the only thing that you can ever predict is that things are going to change. And so for us to be reticent to change is really a losing cause. I mean, we have to understand that things do change and that we have an opportunity to really create that change for ourselves. I think if we fear change, what we're really fearing is the ability to control. And that often comes, at least in Eastern Kentucky, from the outside. We can't control what comes from the outside toward us. But if we are able to step into these gaps ourselves and be able to articulate what we want to allow in and what ideas we want to allow out and how we can begin to really communicate in a way that puts us on the same page, you know, we begin to control that change, not in a way that's heavy-handed, but in a way that is informed. I think that's really the right approach. And so, yeah, are there going to be experiments? For sure. There have to be. But at the same time, we know what we do well, I think, as a people. And I think we see our region for what it is. We have a pretty honest sense of who we are and what we are. And so if we're able to kind of dig in together and if people are able to articulate a way forward, I think other people will follow.
Brent Hutchinson is executive director of the Hyman Settlement School and an Obama Foundation fellow, and he joins us from WMMT at Apple Shop in Whitesburg. Thanks so much, Brent.
Thanks, Tom.
Let's check in with Christine Huskisson of our arts and culture partner, Undermain, about a project now underway.
Undermain is excited to be diving into new territory this summer. We've sent a Kentucky artist out on assignment. Photographer and UK faculty member James Southard is with us today to discuss his three-week-long tour of the Great Lakes region. But before I introduce him, I should say that his adventures are funded in part by the Great Meadows Foundation and are intended to learn more about how artists live and work in the urban areas around Milwaukee and Chicago, around Thunder Bay and Duluth, and the Rust Belt of Cleveland and Detroit. James has set an ambitious itinerary of meeting 27 artists, curators, and craftsmen in 12 different cities over a period of 3 weeks. How's it going, James?
It's going great.
Tell us where you are.
Right now, I am in the farmland of southern Ontario, in between Lake Huron and Toronto. So dead center of the peninsula down there.
For you, if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your journeys. I don't want you to tell too much, though, because we do have a 5-part photo essay series coming up that will be published on Undermain at the end of July. But maybe tell us a little bit about some of the people that you've met.
Sure, yeah. I've met a bunch of different kinds of visual artists and some curators and even a musician or two. And just trying to get to understand how creatives are working and living in the area.
Yeah, I know you've met a number of different people from various places. And one of the most interesting, I think, for us is Thunder Bay. Tell us a little bit about that place.
Yeah, Thunder Bay is interesting. I didn't realize how far north it was until I arrived. It's way up there in northern Ontario. it's an industrial city. It's the farthest, the westernmost port in the Great Lakes. And there's a huge, what they call First Nation presence there, which we would call Native American. So when you're there, there's a lot of Native American art and museums, and you find it in the galleries. And I happened to just luckily be there during a national First Nation celebration. It's a Canadian holiday, and I was there for powwows. I got to see a lot of traditional dance and meeting a few artists while I was up there, too.
Tell us a little bit about how you're photographing.
When I'm photographing them, it's funny. I have some years as my training was as a photojournalist when I was an undergrad at University of Louisville, before I went back to school just to study contemporary art. But my gut instinct is to try to get a picture of someone in their environment or someone in front of their work or someone explaining their work. So I'm always keeping my camera on my hip when I'm interviewing someone, and people keep commenting. They're like, why aren't you taking notes? And I'm like, I have to memorize it. And I want to keep my camera in my hand, not a notepad and pen. So I'm always kind of snapping away. And only when we're finishing an interview and I stood in front of something while they were telling me about it, then I may ask them, hey, can we go back to that spot we were, and can you stand in front of it? So usually when you see someone posing for me, it's because they literally were sitting there talking to me about their work or about living in this community. And I just saw something and I just took a note that I wanted to come back. And sometimes it's off the cuff. I just snapped the camera and that was what's standing in front of me. So even today, I shot a lot of work out in Lake Huron. I got a boat ride out to visit some craftsmen that were working on the a lighthouse in Southampton. And I was snapping away like can be with the waves, rocking the boat around. Most difficult photo shoot, I'd say, of the whole trip so far.
What else do you want to tell us now today about what you might bring back to the conversation in Kentucky about your travels?
You know, I'd always felt that Southern hospitality was, you know, I was thinking about how much in Kentucky we just considered a Southern thing. Like, oh, we're just so friendly here. And if you need help with anything, we always step up and help each other, especially in the art world where, you know, we're a small community where we know each other. So if you need material or you need a venue or what have you, you just reach out to a few people, you can make it happen. And I realize that's the same case up here in Northern Ontario. And as I'm entering Southern Ontario, I'm starting to experience the same thing. So I'm starting to realize, like, you know what? Actually, the arts communities are everywhere more similar than I thought. Because everywhere I've been, I've met the friendliest people that have asked me, you know, like, oh, you know, I just met you 10 minutes ago. Where are you going next? Oh, I know three people, or I know a cabin you can stay in, or I know the material that you can use for that photograph. Like, let me just make some calls. And I'm trying to be polite and say, no, that's okay. Don't worry about it. Or where should I pay? Or like, no, your money's no good. Like, that's happened more often than not. And it's been really impressive. And it reminds me very much of home in Central Kentucky. Makes making art so much easier, I feel, when everyone is supportive and no one's trying to put their guard up because some artist is in front of them.
Well, tell us a little bit more, too, about the funding that you receive from Great Meadows. Just briefly touch on that, if you will.
Sure. The Great Meadows Foundation is a very generous, privately funded grant by Al Shands. And what it does, it supports Kentucky artists and now curators to get outside of the state and visit other communities and see work. So people have used it to fund to go to the Venice Biennial in Italy or Documenta in Germany or go all the way to Tokyo to see a sculpture show. The way I've always wanted to push is, you know, there's so much in North America I've not seen. So I've always used the grant to just get to all the corners of this country and America as well to find out how people are working and living, which I think is one of the biggest questions that, as an American artist. I want to know how all of us are surviving. So Great Meadows has always been so supportive of that.
Wonderful. Yeah, we all look forward to seeing what you bring back to us, James. Safe travels as you enter Lake Erie and Lake Ontario. And for those of you listening today, please watch for James's 5-part photo essay series. It will begin mid to late July. Is that correct, James?
Yes.
And hopefully we'll run them through the end of August. Thanks again, James. Safe travels.
Thank you. Talk to you guys later.
It's not unusual, especially in the summertime, to hear about search and rescue operations in places like the backcountry of the Red River Gorge or other remote areas of Kentucky. What about those situations where you can't count on a rescue? We're joined by archaeologist and wilderness survival instructor Chris Begley for the first in a series about things we need to know to stay safe when venturing into the great outdoors. Chris has learned, applied, and taught survival skills in many different areas, among them tropical rainforests, alpine areas, and of course, right here in Kentucky. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
So, Chris, let's begin with, in what sorts of situations would you need to fend for yourself?
Well, here you can almost always count on search and rescue teams, but that relies on you having done certain things so that people know where to look for you. For instance, if you've not told anyone where you're going, it's going to be hard for them to know where to look for you. Or it could be an unexpected event, a car crash or a plane wreck or something of that sort. And those, I think, are the typical situations where you would need to find your own way home.
Are there some important basic skills that allow you to survive out there?
Yeah, there certainly are. When I teach survival courses, I tend to think of it in those terms as a decision-making process. And this allows you to apply sort of this knowledge to any particular situation. Now, some of the fundamental skills include how to protect yourself from the elements, particularly temperature, cold temperatures, how to find and purify water, what to do about food, and how to find other people so you can get home.
Okay, those are some of the basic decisions you'll have to make. Let's expand on those a little bit. What can you tell us?
Well, your first question might depend on where and how you find yourself in this situation. Were you lost hiking? Have you been in a car wreck? Have you been in a plane crash? These series of questions would start with the most immediate concerns. For instance, I would start by asking, am I safe where I am? Do I need to get out of a plane or this car? I'm in an area where there might be flash floods or avalanches. You might need to get away from your location immediately. The next set of questions would probably involve medical issues. Am I hurt? How badly? What do I need to do to survive my injuries? Am I mobile? Can I walk? Do I need to stop bleeding or splint a broken bone? After that, I think I would look at the elements. Am I at risk of hypothermia or overheating? What can I do to minimize that risk? Water would come next. Do I have any? Can I get some? And how do I make it safe to drink?
What about food? It might seem you're out there in the forest and it looks like there's an abundance of things that you might eat, but is that so?
Well, there might be an abundance of things that you can eat, but it really requires the knowledge to pick the right things. Food is not going to be nearly as important as we think it is and as we often talk about it. You're not going to be gone long enough in most of these scenarios to need food, and you certainly don't want to make it worse by eating something that's toxic. Of all the plant species in North America, over half are toxic to humans during some part of their life cycle. Animals and insects are mostly edible, but they require time and energy to collect, and you really have a couple of weeks before food becomes a real concern.
What if you are genuinely lost out there and you've lost your orientation? We know, of course, the sun comes up in the east, goes down in the west, so we have that going for us. But what are some other general rules?
Well, there are many different ways to ultimately find your way back. One is to do what you would need to do to find other people. And that can often be as simple as finding a waterway, a creek, and follow it downstream to the bigger waterway down to the river, and you'll always find people in that way. If you find a road or a trail, that's going to lead to people. And then there are many ways in which you can tell the direction. Of course, sun comes up in the east, sets in the west. But we can also, from the sun, if we know what time of day it is, tell which way is north and south. We can do that by looking at the stars, of course. We can do it by looking at the moon. We can do it by looking at plants in some cases.
I've heard in the Australian outback, for example, if you're lost out there and you're lucky enough to come upon an anthill, of course, you know, there are those giant anthills, that they are always oriented facing north. So you can tell by looking at one of those which way is north. Are there any natural markers that we might look for in this area?
No, absolutely. We've all heard that moss grows on the north side of trees, and that is true to some degree. There are plants that like the cold, the dark, the wetter areas. Rhododendron or mountain laurel in the gorge, for instance, will typically be in the north or west facing hollers. You might find some of the weather patterns also affecting the way in which plants look. We have prevailing winds from the west. Plants tend to be bent by that wind, and over time, those are sort of permanent features of some of those plants. Or even the fact that the sun is in the southern part of the sky here, you'll see plants growing more robustly in that direction.
So we're heading out there. We know we're going to be out in a wilderness area and maybe totally alone. What essentials do we need to be absolutely certain we have along with us?
Well, probably the most basic thing would be clothing that's appropriate for the weather and the weather that you might encounter if you're out there longer than you think you will be. Most deaths from hypothermia, for instance, happen in situations where it's sunny and warm during the day, maybe in the 50s, and you're hiking with a t-shirt. You get lost, you end up out there at night when the temperature drops into the 30s. Those are the kinds of dangerous situations you might find yourself in. Or you're not dressed appropriately for the weather because you think you're going to be in your car for the entire trip, and then something happens where you have to leave your vehicle. So that would be the first one. The other two things that I would always want to have is some way to start a fire and a knife or some cutting tool.
Well, this is just the beginning of what will be, we think, a really interesting series on how to get by out there in the wilderness. That's archaeologist and wilderness survival instructor Chris Begley. He'll be here on Eastern Standard from time to time offering tips on how to get out there and safely enjoy nature and the environment. Thanks a lot, Chris.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And all current and previous editions of Eastern Standard are available online at esweku.com. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.